Blog Talk Radio.
Dance at the LQ with some denying defiant. I swing bowling. don't believe the hype.
Good evening, good evening, good evening. May 12, 2020, 7 o'clock, East Coast, coming to you live from South Central, Southeastern, whatever you want to call it, North Kakilaki. You're listening to the Ant Canary Experience. I'm your host, Ant Canary, with another episode of last week's news tonight. We've got a lot of information to get to. Going to be here until about 8:30. If you have any phone calls, please save them until I let you know when to call in. I've got news and information that I need to cover. If I have time at the end, I'll take phone calls. If not, this will just be another show that you need to just sit back and listen to. And if you have any questions, just write them down. And then when we go back to next week, we're going to probably go back next couple of weeks. We're going to go back to just one topic shows and a few questions down. And if you can remember them, you can bring them up next week whenever we're sitting on talking about one topic. Tonight, we're going to be talking about five things. So I'm trying to squeeze everything in time. Maybe kind of hard to do, so I may not have time for questions. But, you know, just take in the information. If you have any questions, just save them for later. Like I said, next 2 weeks we're going to do just single topics, and I will keep you posted on those. Tonight, in this episode, I think this is the second episode of this new format. Tonight, we're going to be talking about the young brother that got murdered in Atlanta, Ahmaud Arbery, and he was murdered. There's no, you know, you can put sugar on top of it and coat it and color it and change it all you want to. It was still murder in the street. So we're going to talk about him. We're going to talk about the orange shit giving trying to get rid of the United Postal Service because he doesn't like it, because there were stories going around that we may go to voting by mail, which, you know, he can't stand the idea, and Republicans hate the idea, even though they've been caught numerous times stealing ballots out of the mail. So they should have expertise on stuff like that. We're going to talk about the woman that's accusing Joe Biden of sexual abuse. Yeah, give me a break. That whole story smells fishier than a fish market on a Friday night. We're going to talk about one of the sports that I grew up on and I love it, football, pro football. And there's a double standard in pro football. We're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about why Trump can't keep Obama out of his mouth. And I guess it's because, you know, like the old saying goes, once you go black, you don't go back. And Trump's got he's fiending for Obama. That's why he can't stop talking about him. That's why he can't stop lying about him. But we're going to talk about that. So I'm going to have my usual five clips, and then I've got a bonus clip that I'm going to get into in just a second. So like I said, if you got any questions, just write them down as we're going along. And toward the end of the show, if I have time left, I will open up the phone lines. I'll give you the phone number and open up the lines. And then I'll try to answer as many questions or comments as I can. Because as some of you know, some of you may know, some of you may not know, that I work the night shift. I work third shift. I work about an hour and 15 minutes away. So I leave out here at a certain time so I can get to work and chill and do whatever. I am an essential employee, which means I have been working ever since this whole thing was a little red dot on a map in China. And I've been working through this stuff ever since. So after I do the show, throw on my shoes, and I go to work. So I'm going to try to get stuff in as quick as I can. But if I run out of time, then just save the questions for a later date. But before we get into the show, what I try to do, I think last week I forgot. It was my fault. But what I'll do is before I come on, I'm going to give you updated numbers from the Johns Hopkins site on what this pandemic around the world is doing to. It's just messed up. So I checked it at about 4:12 this afternoon, and I'm just going to give you a few numbers. I'm not going to give you all the numbers. There's a lot of numbers on there. But if you're ever curious about that, just go to Johns Hopkins, and there's a map, and that's the same map that we use at work. And that's the same map that we were using before all this shit went sideways, that if you look at it now, excuse me, most of the country, most of the world is covered in red. The place where this started at was a little red dot in China. Now everything is covered in red. Now there are some spots that don't have any cases, but it's the same map that we use at work, and the whole thing is red. So if you're ever interested in that, just check it out. Johns Hopkins. It's got all your information there. Anything you need, it's got it there. So I'm just going to grab a few numbers right quick, and then we'll jump to the show. There right now, as of 4:12 p.m. this afternoon, there were 4,238,703 confirmed cases. There were 290,269 deaths. That's worldwide. In the United States, the death number is 81,805. And okay. I should have written these numbers down. So, okay. All right. In the United States, we have 1,358,901. The closest country to us is Russia with 232,243. And the country with the lowest number is Western Sahara with 6. Here in North Carolina, where I'm at now, there are 596 deaths. There are 9,115 recovered from the virus. In New York, there is 27,215 deaths, 58,363 that have recovered. In the Virgin Islands, there were only 5 deaths and 60 recovered. So this virus has covered the world and killed people all over the place. And this is the same virus and the same virus that was called a hoax by the Orange Shit Giving. This is the same virus that a lot of people on the right call a hoax, think that this is fake, that it's made up. But what I would like to remind people, if they're listening, that this is not fake. I had to attend a funeral this past Saturday of a family member that caught it. She's not coming back. These people that catch this disease and die, they're not hiding out in closets until Christmas time to pop out and go surprise. They're not coming back. There's nothing fake about it. I guess it's only fake to people until somebody in their family gets affected by it. So this shit ain't fake. I had to go to a funeral for this, and I seen with my own eyes people, family members crying their eyes out. Because she ain't coming back. So for the people sitting around here talking about this is fake, you know, it wouldn't be fake if I stuck my size 9 up your ass. That wouldn't be fake. So, you know, just be stupid somewhere else. This disease is affecting people. Now they're talking about there may be another strain that's just affecting children. So, you know, nobody's got time for you ass clowns to sit up here and say that this is fake. And scream and holler because you want to go get a haircut. These people are not coming back. They're dead. Somebody's mother, somebody's father, somebody's sister, somebody's brother, somebody's uncle, cousin, aunt, whoever. These people are not coming back. So if you think this is fake, why don't you keep that shit to yourself and just keep your mouth closed? Because this right here is affecting a whole lot of people. And there's nothing funny about it. This is not a joke. These people will not be back. Only thing we have left of the family member that died are her pictures, her memories. She's not coming back. You know, she had to be cremated. They buried the urn in the ground, and I saw it. So, you know, if somebody is in my face talking about this is fake, we're going to be fighting because there's nothing fake about it. So if you want to be a douchebag, go be a douchebag somewhere else. Because these are people's family members, these are people's friends, coworkers, whatever, and they're not coming back. So, you know, be a little bit more sensitive. Don't be an asshole. Be sensitive. You know, if your family hadn't been affected by it yet, you know, be thankful that you hadn't been affected by it. Because, you know, people have them covered, which is good, but there have been other people that didn't make it, and they're gone. So this year, after going through all of this mess, you know, just you know, Christmas time is going to be different. Birthdays are going to be different. You know, holidays are going to be different because these people aren't coming back. So don't be an asshole. Go down to your mama's basement and yak about it down there when nobody's listening. But, you know, just go be stupid somewhere else if you don't have any kind of sympathy for people that's got to go through this crap, because there's nothing cute about it. I wouldn't wish this on anybody, on my worst enemy. You know, but you got people running around here with guns on their back, hand grenade, but bazookas and all this kind of shit because they think the shit is cute, and there's nothing cute about it. We had another march in Raleigh today, and these assholes wandering around with guns on their back talking about open up. Open up for what? They're trying to get the curve down. You assholes want to just spike it back up again because you want to be stupid. You know, like I said, go be stupid somewhere else, because I'm not going to be in your number whenever these numbers go back up again. You best believe that. I won't be in that number. My family won't be in that number. Hopefully try to get my grandkids. I don't want them to get sick. So if you want to be stupid, you know, go be stupid somewhere else. Nobody's got time for that crap. Just had to get that off my chest. So I got those numbers out of the way. So we're going to get to, hit the right button, we're going to get to the news from last week. All right, last week's news tonight. So I've got a bonus clip that I want to play. This happened yesterday. This did not happen last week. But I want to put it in because I want to show you what kind of puss bag we have as a president. I didn't vote for him. Means other people voted for him. There are people that like him. He is, to me, he's a douche, and I can say he's a douche, and if people listening don't like me calling him a douche, well, that's not my problem. That is your problem, because that's exactly what he is. When all this stuff started going down, only thing he was worried about was his numbers getting reelected, the economy. He didn't care about nobody else. He was told about this stuff. He called this a Democratic hoax. He played golf. He didn't give a damn. He was told about this months ago. He didn't start trying to do something about it until February. And that's when all hell broke loose. And we're still dealing with it right now. Now, if we had a president with some brains, maybe we wouldn't be going through this stuff. But unfortunately, we have a president with no brains. He's got cow shit for brains. Lots of his followers. And now we're still dealing with this. I just got a feeling, and I'm not a doctor. I don't try to be one. I don't claim to be one. I'm not trying to pretend to be one. But this is already May. We already coming up on the middle of May. I got a feeling this is going to go on until at least the end of the year. Looking at the news, they're trying to come up with some vaccines or whatever. I don't know. Maybe that stuff will help. I have no idea. But I got a feeling this is going to go on until toward the end of the year. And then the other problem that we've got that, you know, flu season kicks in. So we'll be dealing with toward the end of the year, we'll be dealing with all kinds of stuff. You know, kids trying to go back to school, which I don't see happening. I think a lot of kids are going to be going to homeschool. I think this is going to change life as we know it. I have no idea which way it's going to go, but it's going to change a whole lot of people's lives, and just not only in this country, but in this world. But yesterday, your fearless leader got offended at a news conference, and if you hadn't heard it, I'm gonna play in this clip. It's in there. You'll hear the clips. But I'm just gonna say this: I've never been president, but I think I've seen enough things that presidents do when they have news conferences. People ask questions, and they pretty much want you to answer them. The orange puss bag is afraid. We've already figured this out. Is afraid of strong women. He don't like women. Well, only time he likes women are when he screws them. He doesn't like minorities. He hates Mexicans. He don't like black people, even though he tries to pretend that he likes black folks. He don't like black people. Only time he likes a black person if they're serving him food at one of his resorts. Other than that, he could care less for black folks. But he's got a lot of black people thinking that he likes them when he probably don't. He would probably piss on them in the street if he could get away with it. But he was asked questions at a news conference, and he decided he couldn't answer the question, so he ran out. Now, this is the same person that a lot of his fans, I call them fans, think he's the greatest to ever live. He's a piece of shit. And I've said it from the beginning, and I'll keep saying it until his last day in the White House. He's a piece of shit. I get in arguments with people about this on social media all the time. He's a piece of shit. And if I can see it, and if you can't see it, then that's not my problem. That's your problem. He has no business being in the White House. He has no business being in charge of anything. He surrounds himself with people that just agree to everything. Yes, man. Yeah, I agree. You know, if they get on his bad side, he goes off on them like a 10-year-old kid online. He scares people into liking him. He's a piece of shit. But, you know, if you like him, well, that means that you like shit. So I want to play this clip from yesterday when he was at the this press conference, when he decided that he couldn't answer questions like a normal human being, and how he got out of not answering questions. Let me play. This is going to be the bonus clip. Listen to this.
This is the Dollemore Daily, and I'm Jesse Dollemore.
Yesterday, Donald Trump held a press conference, a coronavirus-related press conference, in the Rose Garden at the White House. Literal steps away from the Oval Office. Sacred ground to some. Not to Trump. And at this press conference, there were a few moments that I want to talk about. I'm going to play four separate clips, all very brief. I know how everybody hates being subjected to Trump. But these clips are, well, one is just Trump, but the others are journalism. Real questions, valid questions being asked, and this human tapeworm, this sickening virus of a human being, Donald Trump, takes it upon himself to take offense and then act like a baby or say racist things or storm out, ultimately, is what he did. First, and I have talked about this in the past, that Donald Trump has come very close to having his, what I call a mission accomplished moment, akin to what George W. Bush did when he flew in onto the aircraft carrier with the big sign above his head, giving a speech on the deck of the aircraft carrier that said, mission accomplished, relative to the Iraq war, when we would be there for years and years and years after that speech. There was no mission accomplished yet. Some would argue there was never a mission accomplished. I would be one of them. But Donald Trump said something very troubling and remarkably daft. Maybe even for him. Let's take a look.
Challenge and hardship and danger. America has risen to the task. We have met the moment, and we have prevailed. Americans do whatever it takes to find solutions, pioneer breakthroughs, and harness the energies we need to achieve a total victory. Day after day, we're making tremendous strides with the dedication of our doctors and nurses. These are incredible people. These are brave people. These are warriors.
We have risen to the task. We have met the moment. We have prevailed. Have we, though? Yesterday was the day that this press conference was given, and yesterday was the day that we surpassed 80,000 dead Americans at the hands of COVID-19 that didn't otherwise need to die. People compare this to the flu or drowning in a pool or cancer or heart disease or any number of fatalities. But this is an extra 80,000 dead that didn't need to die. mothers and fathers and uncles and children, grandchildren, Americans, human beings. I think that gets lost a lot, that these were 80,000, that these are unnecessary deaths. And had this administration, had Donald Trump acted earlier or acted with any modicum of leadership, this very well would have been a lot fewer people dead. And here he is with his Mission Impossible, or his mission accomplished moment. For him, it isn't Mission Impossible. Saying that we have prevailed, while still 2,000 or so per day Americans are dying, we haven't gotten this thing under control. There still isn't the ability to test everyone who wants a test. We still don't have the ability to test everyone who needs a test. And here's this goon claiming victory, having done nothing. This weekend, Donald Trump went on a tweet binge. One of the days this weekend, he tweeted over 100 times, tweeted or retweeted people over 100 times. And some of that was over Obama, the crimes that Obama committed. Because, you know, Obama is still president or in power, apparently. And Donald Trump needs a foil. Donald Trump needs an enemy. Can't be Hillary anymore. Why not make it the president who's not the president? Or the leader of the party, or really anything other than a private citizen now, accusing him of crimes. Well, Phil Rucker from the Washington Post asked specifically about what exactly are those crimes that you're talking about as president of the United States, the chief law enforcement officer, the highest ranking individual in the executive branch, which is over the Justice Department. You have an attorney general at your disposal who does your bidding anyway. If Obama actually committed crimes, clown, prosecute him, investigate him. This was the question, and his remarkably stupid, stupid answer.
Go ahead, Phil.
Mr. President, in one of your Mother's Day tweets, you appear to accuse President Obama of the biggest political crime in American history by far. Those were your words. What crime exactly are you accusing President Obama of committing, and do you believe the Justice Department should prosecute him?
Obamagate. It's been going on for a long time. It's been going on from before I even got elected, and it's a disgrace that it happened. And if you look at what's gone on, and if you look at now all of this information that's being released, and from what I understand, that's only the beginning. Some terrible things happened, and it should never be allowed to happen in our country again. And you'll be seeing what's going on over the coming weeks. But I wish you'd write honestly about it, but unfortunately, you choose not to do so. Yeah, John, please.
Crime. What is the crime exactly that you're accusing him of?
You know what the crime is. The crime is very obvious to everybody. All you have to do is read the newspapers, except yours. John, please.
Yeah, Mr. President.
You know what the crime is. What's the crime? Well, you know what the crime is. It's very obvious what the crime is. Well, if it's so obvious, why don't you tell everybody, guy? Why don't you tell everybody, smart guy? There's no crime. President Obama sat over an administration that was historically squeaky clean. Some say zero scandal. And those that did exist were manufactured by a Republican Party that needed to do something to delegitimize the first black president of the United States, Benghazi, other investigations that went on and on and on and on, fast and furious, you heard about on Fox News. Zero indictments. Zero indictments. If there was such corruption, rife corruption in the Obama administration, why were there zero indictments, zero prosecutions? That certainly can't be said of the previous George W. Bush administration, and it certainly can't be said of Donald Trump's administration. Donald Trump is he's evaporating cognitively right before our eyes. What's the crime? You know the crime. Everybody knows the crime. I mentioned racism earlier. Donald Trump certainly spills into racist diatribes often. Sometimes it's more of the dog whistle nature. Other times it's pretty blatant. This is Weijia Chang from CBS, Chinese-American, intrepid journalist, professional, asking a question about why Donald Trump insists on making our coronavirus response and testing and several other metrics, why he insists on making it a competition globally. And I think he probably thinks he knocked this one out of the park, although it turned racist real quick.
Yeah, go ahead, please.
I've said many times that the U.S. is doing far better than any other country when it comes to testing.
Yes.
Why does that matter? Why is this a global competition to you if everyday Americans are still losing their lives and we're still seeing more cases every day?
Well, they're losing their lives everywhere in the world. And maybe that's a question you should ask China. Don't ask me. Ask China that question, okay? When you ask them that question, you may get a very unusual answer. Yes, behind you, please.
Sir, why are you saying that to me specifically?
I'm telling you. I'm not saying it specifically to anybody. I'm saying it to anybody that would ask a nasty question
that's
like that.
That's not a nasty question.
Please go ahead.
Why does it matter?
Okay. Anybody else? Please, go ahead in the back, please.
I have two questions.
No, it's okay.
But
we'll
you pointed
here.
To me. I have two questions, Mr.
Next.
President.
Next, please.
But you did. You called on me.
So
I did.
I'm going to cut that there.
And now I'm calling on.
This is what took place there. She is Chinese American, and he's asking. You should ask China. Like she has some in with the Chinese government. She's a White House correspondent. She's not an international relations reporter. She doesn't report on the State Department. She reports on the White House. A White House correspondent, just like everybody else who's asking questions there. Her beat isn't China. Her beat isn't East Asia. Her beat isn't international. It's the White House. She's asking you, Donald. You clown. Because you're the president, and that is her beat as a reporter. And then what happened there at the end, I'm going to play this. Caitlin Collins from CNN asks a question, or goes to ask a question. He calls on her. And I guess because everybody's wearing a face mask, he can't really tell who's who. And then when he recognizes that it's Caitlin Collins, he pulls the plug, tries to walk away. Ultimately does. He ends it. He will not allow her to ask a question. She is a strong reporter. Watch how this went down. And note, particularly, a lot of times I play these clips directly from the White House feed. I didn't this time because C-SPAN 3, where this footage is from, they carried it all the way out. The White House ended it right away. They faded to black. They followed him haughtily and walking back to the Oval Office like a toddler on a playground or a young child on a playground who takes his ball and goes home.
Okay, anybody else? Please, go ahead in the back, please.
I have two questions.
No, it's okay.
But
we'll
you pointed to me. I have two questions, Mr.
Next,
President.
Next, please.
But you called on me.
I did, and you didn't respond, and now I'm calling on
sorry,
the young lady in the back, please.
I just wanted to let my colleagues
okay.
finish, but can I ask
ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much. Appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Look at him walk away. He lumbers away in his poorly fitting suit. Hairpiece flipping in the breeze. His cotton candy covered dog piss hair. What is happening? Donald Trump is a disgraceful man. He is a disgrace as a president. He is an embarrassment. The only people who watch this and are proud of that disgusting performance are the poorly educated he loves to tout so much, the MAGA hats, the people with no understanding of decorum, presidential or otherwise. This was an embarrassment. I'd love to know what you think. 657, that's another phone number for my podcast. 714-576-4054.
So that was a bonus clip. So the first clip we're going to play, this is from Don Lemon of CNN. And the other night he went ham on the orange shit giving, which is something that people, I think, should start doing instead of just sitting there taking his shit. They should just start unloading on him. And then maybe he'll come around and act like he won't. Listen to this.
This is CNN Tonight. I'm Don Lemon. Here's our breaking news. There are now more than 1,150,000 cases of coronavirus in this country. More than 67,000 Americans have died. And if you are having trouble wrapping your head around that number, well, I want you to think of this. More than 13,000 people died in just the past week, just since last Sunday. So don't let anyone tell you that this is over, because it is not. The coronavirus is still killing thousands of Americans every single week. We still don't have the testing we need, and that is a disgrace, quite frankly. Nearly 2 months after the president promised, anybody who needs a test gets a test. And we're still a long way away from a vaccine. But governors across the country are under pressure to open up and get their states back in business. More than 30 states have started reopening businesses and easing stay-at-home orders. More to come this week. But as more and more reopen without even having met the president's vague guidelines, I want you to listen to what the president said just moments ago about the projected death toll.
I used to say 65,000, and now I'm saying 80 or 90, and it goes up, and it goes up rapidly. But it's still going to be, no matter how you look at it, at the very lower end of the plane if we did the shutdown.
But that is after Dr. Deborah Birx, claimed today that the White House always projected up to 240,000 deaths from the coronavirus.
Our projections have always been between 100 and 240,000 American lives lost, and that's with full mitigation and us learning from each other of how to social distance.
So that's what you call a contradiction. But this isn't the first time the president has contradicted his own experts.
It's looking like it's heading to 50,000 or more deaths, not cases, 50,000 deaths. So we're talking about maybe 60,000 or so. That's a lot of people, but that's 100,000 was the minimum we thought that we could get to, and we will be lower than that number. We would have had millions of deaths instead of, it looks like we'll be at about a 60,000 mark, which is 40,000 less than the lowest number thought of. Now, with all of the death that we've seen at 50 or 60,000 people heading toward, right now it's at 40, but 50 or 60,000 people, probably over 54, I see.
Yeah, we've lost a lot of people, but if you look at what original projections were, 2.2 million, we're probably heading to 60,000, 70,000.
Okay, and let's not forget this stunning statement from the president's own son-in-law and his senior advisor, Jared Kushner, calling the administration's coronavirus response a great success story.
We're on the other side of the medical aspect of this, and I think that we've achieved all the different milestones that are needed. So federal government rose to the challenge, and this is a great success story.
This is no success story. Not while deaths are still climbing. But the president tonight is trying to pivot to reopening the economy.
I think we're going to have an incredible following year. We're going to go into a transition in the third quarter, and we're going to see things happening that look good. I really believe that. I have a good feel for this stuff. I've done it for a long time.
So I've said it before. Everybody wants the economy to come back. Come on. People are hurting. Millions of jobs lost. Millions of people not sure where to get the money to pay the rent and put food on the table. But the president wants to be able to showcase an economic recovery. It's his ace in the hole with Election Day just 6 months away. And he just can't seem to muster the kind of compassion that we need from our president. With more and more Americans getting sick and more Americans dying, he is longing to get back to crowded campaign rallies, right? Siri says, hopefully our country will soon mend. We are all missing our wonderful rallies and many other things. No, we're not. He's bragging about his golf courses. And then there is this, one of the most transparent and ludicrous attempts at distraction that we have seen from a president who has got a million of them, retweeting an utterly absurd claim by a conspiracy theorist that the former President Barack Obama was behind what he calls the Russia hoax. This one is really a new low from a president who goes low all the time. It is obviously completely untrue. It's a disturbed fantasy. And just as obviously, he doesn't really expect you to believe it. He just wants to turn the page, to get you to think about something, anything, other than one of the worst crises in this nation's history. Look in the mirror, Mr. President. It's you. And this is nothing but a shameless attempt to distract from your own administration's mishandling of a crisis that's cost over 67,000 American lives. And by the way, you were warned about a pandemic like this by the Obama administration. Yet at a time when we need leadership, when we need compassion, this is the crap that you're peddling, conspiracy theories. Like I said, it is shameful. But thank goodness there is a president, a real president that is showing compassion for his fellow Americans. And it is not President Trump. It is former President George W. Bush with a message full of images of and concern for all Americans.
Let's remember that the suffering we experience as a nation does not fall evenly. In the days to come, it will be especially important to care in practical ways for the elderly, the ill, and the unemployed. Finally, let us remember how small our differences are in the face of this shared threat. In the final analysis, we are not partisan combatants. We are human beings, equally vulnerable and equally wonderful in the sight of God. We rise or fall together, and we are determined to rise.
And how does President Trump respond? Predictably, he makes it all about him, about his wounded pride, his constant airing of grievances, tweeting that former President Bush didn't defend him on impeachment. The president's impeachment trial ended in his acquittal on February 5th. The very next day, the first American died of the coronavirus. More than 67,000 Americans have died since then. How about thinking about them for a change instead of nursing your grudges? How about showing some compassion? Former President Bush did it. So did former President Barack Obama.
Hi, everybody. Let me start by saying the obvious. These aren't normal times. As we all manage our way through a pandemic unlike anything we've seen in a century, Michelle and I hope that you and your families are safe and well. If you've lost somebody to this virus, or if someone in your life is sick, or if you're one of the millions suffering economic hardship, please know that you're in our prayers. Please know that you're not alone, because now's the time for all of us to help where we can and to be there for each other, as neighbors, as co-workers, and as fellow citizens. In fact, over the past weeks, we've seen plenty of examples of the kind of courage, kindness, and selflessness that we're going to need to get through one of the most difficult times in our history.
Boy, oh boy, that's leadership. That's compassion. It's too bad that President Trump can't show either. By the way, what is it about President Obama that really gets under your skin? Is it because he's smarter than you? Better educated? Made it on his own? Didn't need daddy's help?
wife is more accomplished, better looking. I don't know. What is it? What is it about him? That he's a black man that's accomplished, became president. That he punked you on the whole birth certificate thing. What is it about him? Just wondering.
Number two, we're going to talk about the young man, Ahmaud Arbery, that was murdered in Georgia. This is from Roland Martin. This is from last week. We're going to talk about that case.
You want to support Roland Martin Unfiltered? Be sure to join our Bring the Funk fan club. Every dollar that you give to us supports our daily digital show. There's only one daily digital show out here that keeps it black and keep it real. It's Roland Martin Unfiltered. Support the Roland Martin Unfiltered daily digital show by going to RolandMartinUnfiltered.com. You can make this possible.
Folks, 25-year-old Ahmaud Arbery jogging in Brunswick, Georgia on Sunday when he passed a man who was standing in his front yard. That man tells cops later that he looked like somebody who was involved in a string of break-ins in the neighborhood. Now, according to police, Gregory McMichael grabbed his gun and his son, Travis McMichael, hopped into their truck to chase down this brother. They ended up shooting and killing him. But why aren't they in jail? How is it self-defense when the brother is jogging, minding his own business? Joining us right now is Lee Merrick. He is an attorney for the family of the man who was shot and killed, Ahmaud Arbery. Lee, glad to have you back on Roland Martin Unfiltered. So how are these two not arrested for murder?
Very important to note, and as you pointed out, that the father of the shooter, is former law enforcement. He was in the district attorney's office for that county for the last two decades, and before that, he was a police officer. And so the district attorney, who will be responsible for the indictment, backed out of it almost immediately because he had a personal relationship with him. It transferred this case over to the next jurisdiction, and that DA backed himself out of it as well. They had to transfer it a third time. It is now with the DA for Liberty County in South Georgia. We are encouraging everyone to call Liberty County, where it's been for the past 2 months, and encourage them to start an investigation. Because when we called the GBI, they had not been called to investigate this case yet.
Now, this happened, first of all, I said at the top, I said Sunday. It did not happen Sunday. First of all, the date was February 23rd when this actually happened. The father and the son grabbed a .357 as well as a shotgun, followed. They pull up to him while he's jogging, shout, "Stop, we want to talk to you." First of all, Arbery doesn't know who the hell these guys are. Why are these two white guys in his neighborhood asking him to stop? Under what authority did they have to even demand that he stop and talk to them?
Roland, I have to tell you, I believe that they were actually acting under police authority, both as being former law enforcement and because police, I'm told by witnesses, were on the scene within seconds. And so that means law enforcement had already been contacted, and there was likely some sort of communication between this police officer for two decades and law enforcement who arrived to the scene prior to the shooting.
Now, this is I'm reading a piece from the New York Times. According to documents obtained by the New York Times, a prosecutor who had the case for a few weeks told the police that the pursuers had acted within the scope of Georgia's citizen's arrest statute and that Travis McMichael, who held the shotgun, had acted out of self-defense. First of all, let's just reset this. Go ahead.
I was going to say that was nothing more than opinion by a friend of the shooter, right? And so this was not a legal opinion. Any attorney, I've spoken to the attorneys both in the state of Georgia and other people who have just looked at federal law, because that law in the first place needs to be challenged on its face, because the idea may be race neutral, but in places like South Georgia, that is giving white vigilantes a green light to go hunt down black people. That's how that law works out. So that law needs to be challenged on its face. But even under the law, it fails to meet the proper standards. He did not conduct himself as a person who was apprehending a suspect. He conducted himself as a person going out hunting for a black man.
Well, here's what's interesting. Again, I'm reading the New York Times piece. But others contend that Mr. Arbery was up to no good. On the day of the shooting and apparently moments before the chase, a neighbor in Satilla Shores, where he was running, called 911, telling the dispatcher that a black man in a white T-shirt was inside a house that was under construction and only partially closed in. And he's running right now, the man told the dispatcher. There he goes right now. Then it says in his letter to the police, Mr. Barnhill, the prosecutor, noted that Mr. Arbery had a criminal past. He was convicted of shoplifting and of violating probation in 2018. 5 years earlier, he was indicted on charges that he took a handgun to a high school basketball game. Okay, but here's the problem here. There is nothing to indicate he was robbing a place. Nothing. And so how can you make a citizen's arrest and the only thing that you have in the case is this black guy jogging?
Right. Even the so-called dwelling that they were qualifying, you cannot burglarize a dwelling with no doors. That's impossible. And so this dwelling that he allegedly was seen in, or someone with a white, some black person with a white T-shirt was seen in, was a dwelling without any windows or doors. You can't burglarize that under the legal definition.
First of all, is there an actual investigation? It's been transferred, but is there an investigation? Is that prosecutor's office? I mean, like, is someone actually doing an investigation?
My office contacted the GBI, the Georgia Bureau of Investigation. They will require the DA, when they receive the file, because the DA is not from that county, he can't send out his investigators, he would have to contact the GBI to help him with the investigation. When I spoke with the GBI earlier today, they said they had not received a phone call from the district attorney over the case.
Okay, so you're representing the family. Has this prosecutor even talked to the family and given them an update of what's going on?
The family was told that they received the file 2 months ago, and they have not heard from them since. We contacted the district attorney's office today. My office has been calling nonstop. They have refused to answer our calls. We sent out a certified letter today to put them on notice that this victim's family needs to liaison with them, which is what they're required to do under the law.
Wow, this is a story that has not gotten lots of traction, primarily because of obviously all the attention being on coronavirus. Now, the family of Mr. Arbery has certainly, they've been trying to raise the attention on social media. The hashtag I run with Maud, M-A-U-D, or also Justice for Ahmaud, A-H-M-A-U-D. They printed up T-shirts, things along those lines as well. This is just stunning that 2 months have gone by and you do not have what should be a real investigation taking place. This black man is dead, 25 years old. These two folks are walking around free. And so what? I mean, are they saying that in Georgia you get to basically accost anybody who's black regardless of what they're doing?
The scary thing about this case is what happened was horrific enough. That's every mother's fear, that their son just goes for a jog and is randomly killed by two white vigilantes. That's scary enough. But how the city, the people responsible for investigating, prosecuting the men who did this, how they've handled it since is actually more scary. That's actually what makes it a lynching, Roland. It's because it's sending a signal to that entire community that you're not protected, that you're not safe, because vigilantes can do this to you and nothing will be done to them.
What's crazy here is that the prosecutor who basically said nothing really happened here, again, read the New York Times, Mr. Barnhill, wrote that he did not believe there was evidence of a crime. noting that Gregory McMichael and his son have been legally carrying their weapons under Georgia law. And because Mr. Arbery was a burglary suspect, the pursuers who had solid firsthand probable cause were justified in chasing him under the state citizen's arrest law. Okay, here's what I'm trying to understand. He was jogging by. How did those two have probable cause, and how did he go from a guy jogging to being a suspect? Did these two see him steal something? Did these two hear a neighbor say, hey, that man just stole something? I mean, how does Barnhill arrive at these conclusions?
This is my suspicion. I just got involved with this case 24 hours ago. But my guess is that this young, that these two men were coordinating directly with law enforcement. I say that because, as I said at the top, I've spoken with witnesses who actually present during the shooting, nearby neighbors, who said that, law enforcement came in, responded within seconds of the shooting, that they were already out, essentially, or near the area of the shooting. I believe that this 30-year lawman had already been coordinated with law enforcement before he killed Ahmad.
Oh, I think when you read this, and first of all, again, they claim there was a video shot by a third bystander, and that according to them, the video shows Arbery tried to grab the shotgun. Again, I'm reading from the New York Times, grab the shotgun from Travis McMichael's hands, Mr. Barnhill wrote, and that he argued amounts to self-defense under Georgia law. I don't care if you have a right to carry a gun, you don't have the right to accost me and stop me. And if all of a sudden, if two white guys in a truck in Georgia roll up saying, stop, we want to talk to you, and they get out with a gun, I'm damn sure not going to just stand there and go, okay, sure, let's have a conversation.
No, absolutely not. So that law doesn't deputize the entire population to obey white men. I mean, that's essentially how the law would have to work. Then when men show up with guns and tell you to stop, then you have to stop or you can be killed.
This is, again, an absolutely stunning story, a tragic story. Lee Merritt, we certainly appreciate it. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
All right, I want to bring in my panel right now. Adrian Ermer, she's a fellow for the New Leaders Council of Chicago. Malik Abdul, Republican strategist. Kelly Bethea, communication strategist. Adrian, I'll start with you. I mean, to listen to the details of this story, it is shocking, it's stunning, it's sad, but what you're also seeing is clear protection of one of their own by these prosecutors.
Yeah, I would have to agree there, but I also want to echo what Lee was saying in that these laws are supposed to be race neutral, but when you're in a place in small town Georgia, these aren't race neutral policies. And it does effectively become, if a white man pulls up and asks you to have a conversation with a gun in his hand, you're just supposed to acquiesce and submit. You know, I did some digging around online, and I'm not an attorney, and I wish Lee was still here, because citizens arrest laws are the ones that I've seen require that you physically witness the crime happening. And these two men clearly didn't witness anything. They saw this young man taking a jog, running, and they presumed guilt because of the color of his skin in the neighborhood that he was in. So, you know, I'm hoping that justice can be served for this young man and his family, because this is tragic and sort of racism at its worst.
First of all, you're absolutely right. What you have here, again, you do have sort of this breakdown of laws. Kelly, I want to go with you. This whole idea that Arbery still just stopped, hey, what you guys like? That's insane. I mean, I don't know of anybody, whether you're black or white, Latino or Asian, where if somebody just rolls up on you in a truck and yells, hey, stop, we want to talk to you, that you're going to be like, sure, how might I help you?
If not only that, if somebody rolled up on me in a truck and I am, you know, just minding my business, that would prompt me to run. That would prompt me to get away, because just based off of history and what I was taught, how I learned to conduct myself in the world, that's a threat, especially if I don't know you. So the fact that this young man was in Georgia minding his business for all, you know, all intents and purposes, two white men in a truck rolling up on a young black man for no reason, there's nothing there that supports that these men knew what was happening. There's no reason to purport that this was even a citizen's arrest, because like my colleague just said, citizen's arrest typically means that you saw the crime in progress, and because police are not there in a given time frame in order to arrest at that time, lest the person get away, that's when a citizen's arrest is warranted, so that you are there like a placeholder for the police, but only for a short amount of time. A citizen's arrest does not include you chasing somebody down in a car to accost them and then shoot them. That's not a citizen's arrest. That's a murder.
Agreed.
Melick, I'm sitting here reading. This is the Georgia Code. It says 2010 Georgia Code, Title 17, Chapter 4, Article 4, arrest by private persons. A private person may arrest an offender if the offense is committed in his presence or within his immediate knowledge. If the offense is a felony and the offender is escaping or attempting to escape, I'll go to my iPad here, and I want you to see this again. I'll go back. If the offense is a felony and the offender is escaping or attempting to escape, a private person may arrest him upon reasonable and probable grounds of suspicion. Now, that's reading the actual code. Now, I want to read for you. This is from the Georgia Legal Aid website. When it speaks of citizens' arrest, and let me get to it here. And so here's the section here. When making a citizen's arrest, a person may not use more force than is reasonable to make the arrest. Deadly force is limited to self-defense or to instances in which such force is necessary to prevent certain felonies. It must be stressed that the right of private citizens to make a citizen's arrest is limited. The fact that this prosecutor is serving as essentially the defense attorney for these two men shows you why they should have been recused. But the other issue is the fact that this prosecutor has already laid out a statement of facts for another prosecutor now take into account. That prosecutor, the moment, McMichael's involved, he used to be an investigator for our office, I can't touch this case, it needs to be transferred. The fact that this prosecutor's already outlined this whole deal, meaning he has established a narrative for the purpose of defending both of these men.
I'm pretty positive that I'm not the only one who immediately thought of Trayvon Martin. And what happened with George Zimmerman, as he decided to do. And in that case, he was in contact with law enforcement, who told him not to pursue Trayvon Martin, and that's exactly what he did, ultimately killing him. And as we talked about with Trayvon, I'm pretty sure that anyone who's approached by strangers would be apprehensive, would be have any reservations or whatever. So the fact that something like this is happening again, then it was argued, understand your ground laws. Under that actual those grounds, George Zimmerman got off. It seems as if in this case, that this case is a little, to me, a little more clear cut than what we had in Trayvon Martin's. I'm sorry, this one isn't as clear cut as what we had in the Trayvon Martin case, but the law, the application of the law is, I think that's probably what we're going to be looking at, how it's resolved. But once again, we're reminded of, for us, what it feels like being black in America. And I think that those, the gentleman, I can't remember his name, but I think that the victim in this case, he should definitely have his rights protected and whatever the family and the public can do to make sure that he this case gets some attention, I'm hoping that that happens and that it's resolved.
And, of course, so first of all, Ahmaud Arbery was actually killed 3 days before the 8th anniversary of the shooting death of Trayvon Martin. We certainly are going to continue to watch this story and pay very much attention to what is going on. Every single night.
Okay. Looks like we're going to be pressed for time. And I've got three more clips. I want to play one. The last one is the longest one. I'll save the other two for next week, but I want to play this one. This one, I don't know if you've heard this, but this one has to do with a young man that was drafted into the NFL a couple of weeks ago, and he had tattoos on his arms, and they were tattoos from one of these fringe groups, and we bring this up. It's because it's hard to believe that nobody saw these tattoos on this guy's arms. They're from some one of these right-wing nut job groups, and he had it on his arm, and he claimed he didn't know what it was, and blah, blah, blah. I don't have any tattoos on me, but I'd be damned if I just have any tattoo put on me, and I don't know what the hell it is. I'm just saying. So I want to play this. This will be the last clip, and I'll save the other two clips for probably next week. But I want you to, and I like the NFL, but this right here is hypocrisy to the 20th degree.
You want to support Roller March Unfiltered? Be sure to join our Bring the Funk fan club. Every dollar that you give to us supports our daily digital show. There's only one daily digital show out here that keeps it black and keep it real as Roller March Unfiltered. Support the Roland Martin Unfiltered Daily Digital Show by going to RolandMartinUnfiltered.com. You can make this possible.
All right, folks, if you're drafted in the NFL, it should be a great day. But New England Patriots kicker Justin Rohrwasser has had a hell of a problem for the last week. Of course, he's received a lot of criticism for a tattoo he got when he was 18 years old. The tattoo on his left forearm resembles the logo of a far right-wing militia group, the Three Percenters. Rohrwasser said that he had a different understanding of the tattoo's meaning until recently when someone on social media linked the tattoo with the 2017 Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, Virginia. Now, he initially told reporters that he would have the tattoo covered up, but recently decided that he will get it removed. Of course, this is being talked about back and forth from a lot of different people. And, of course, Jason Whitlock came to his defense by saying people like Jemele Hill, Bomani Jones, and others don't know what they're talking about by calling this group racist. Listen to this.
Well, at the end of the day, as someone that prides myself on being a journalist, what's happening to this kid is unfair. It's the role of the media not to be unfair to individuals. Again, there's no proof that this particular group, the Three Percenters, who none of us had heard of until this controversy, or most of us, 99.9%, had never heard of. There's no proof the organization's racist. The group is pro-guns and pro-limited government. That's been pretty clear. And so for Jemele Hill, Bomani Jones, or anybody else who has no other credibility, no other traction other than unfairly tarnishing people with charges of racism, yeah, maybe they won't let it go, but it should end. And I do think the conversation and the remarks from his teammates, I do think they are valid. When people besmirch your character in any way, you call in character witnesses, and the words of people that actually have played with this young man is more valid than Jemele Hill on a Twitter feed or Bomani Jones firing off an irresponsible column on The Undefeated. The words of the people that actually
right,
have interacted
so,
with him, because trust me on
y'all.
This,
okay,
if they ever
I,
ask
take
me
the audio,
about
guys.
Some of my
take
Ball
it out.
State team.
I got enough of Jason Whitlock. All right, let's bring in sports journalist Howard Bryant. All right, Howard, look, you've covered sports. You've covered Boston sports very well. Just your take on this whole deal. First, that he says, Jason, that he thought that, excuse me, this Justin Rohrwasser, he thought that this was a military symbol when he first got it. Then later said, oh, I didn't know what that was. Just what do you make of all of this?
Well, first of all, I'm throwing a 15-yard flag on you, Roland, for throwing Jason Whitlock on this at all in the first place. That's 15 yards at least.
Well, you know, well, first of all, you always got to show buffoonery when anytime you can. We do have a segment called Crazy Ass White People, and so I might as well have one called Crazy Ass Black People. But go ahead.
No, my original feeling is that I think that when you're looking at him as a character, as a person, you're responsible for your own actions. And I think that what does it say about you if you're putting things in your body if you don't know what they mean? And what does it say about the vetting process of the NFL where you can go and you can ask all kinds of questions about the personal lives of these athletes, especially the black athletes? You're going to talk about Dez Bryant's mother, and you're going to talk about these different athletes whose parents, you know, family members have drug issues, but you're not going to comment on this. Essentially, what you're talking about is it's a free pass that these guys have because they're not paying attention. And you don't even need to extrapolate much further than that in terms of what the priorities are. And, you know, I wasn't really surprised by the number of people who sort of fell over backwards to protect or defend him. I just look at it this way. How many people put things in their body that are permanent and they have no idea what they mean?
Right. And look, first of all, I don't have a tattoo, never going to have a tattoo. You ain't got to brand my ass. I know exactly who I am, and I can remember my name. But the reality is that, and then, of course, when Whitlock spouts off, oh, well, no one ever heard of this group. Well, first of all, the Southern Poverty Law Center characterizes nearly 600 extremist groups. And so it's not like you're walking around and you're memorizing all 600 extremist groups. And the reality is, these extremist groups that Jason just acts like is no big deal, those are the people who were in Michigan today. Those are the people who are in the state capitol in Wisconsin. Those are the people who parade around with their guns, flashing their guns. And, in fact, again, in Canada, they consider them the most dangerous extremist group there. To your point, the NFL, it's amazing how they will go deep into your family. Talking about drugs and your associates. Look at Bill O'Brien questioning who DeAndre Hopkins has around, trying to bring up Aaron Hernandez. And so, yeah, this is going to get dealt with. And when the public sees it, they're going to say, hey, what's that on your arm?
Well, exactly. And I think that's the issue that people aren't paying very much attention to is this is also a labor issue in terms of the entire interview process when it comes to the draft, the entire process on how you treat these black athletes and how you treat the white athletes. And also, I mean, let's face it, if you're looking at the NFL, and, you know, you and I have been having this conversation for years anyway, just the level of subtle and not very subtle anti-blackness in the sport. Let's not forget Riley Cooper with the Philadelphia Eagles. Let's not forget the anti-Kaepernick sentiments. Let's not forget what's happening here with the Patriots. I mean, there is absolutely a pattern with what takes place in that locker room and who gets scrutinized and who doesn't get scrutinized. And it's something that needs to be looked at much, much more on the part of the journalists covering these teams, simply because at the very least, you've got a double standard in terms of the evaluation process.
And look, first of all, let me go ahead and say this here. I mean, I don't have to defend him. He can defend himself. But frankly, Jason was idiotic because what Bomani said in his column was very simple, that more questions should be asked. Simple as that.
The point.
And especially when we see how many of these coaches and general managers, they will ask a black athlete a whole lot of questions. In fact, a lot of people are still pissed off with the NFL for what they did on draft night, where you swear we had to bring up every draft pick whose mama or daddy was in jail or who had a drug problem, who had gotten arrested. And I'm sitting there going, what the hell does that have to do with draft night?
That's right. And if it's that much of an issue, if you're going to sort of create storylines and because what they're doing is that they're furthering the same NFL as savior, debtor in jail, sort of golden ticket narrative that they like to push, that race in the United States is essentially a lottery. And that if you make it big, if you've got the talent to be in the NFL, you can put the class past that you may have behind you. And so that puts the NFL in this positive light of being the savior. when it really is just completely offensive. What it really is why are you in my family's business in the first place? And if it's that big an issue for you, if you're going to try to create an issue, then why are you drafting me in the first place? It's insulting to the families, and instead what they're doing is they're using it as part of the NFL and the sports storyline, especially when it comes to black athletes in general. If it weren't for us, you'd be in jail or you'd be dead or have some drug problem.
There's a line here that I love that Bomani said. He said, but guys like Roarwasser rarely have to answer for themselves. And when they do, they get patted on the back, like he's mentioned someone named Burton, a black reporter, did by telling his audience he didn't think Roarwasser was a racist and telling viewers to give the kid a chance. Okay, so let me sort of unpack this, because, see, this is part of the problem that people have. First of all, I don't see anywhere in here in this article, Jason, think you're dead wrong, where Bomani called the kid a racist. It's not in the article. But here's the problem with this whole deal. Whenever we have these discussions, they're framed in racist, not racist. When, if he does have a tattoo of a group that's an anti-government militia group, you damn right you should be asking those questions, because these are the same people who went after Colin Kaepernick for wearing socks.
Well, and also let's...
For wearing a Fidel Castro shirt. So why does he get to be questioned, but this kid can't be questioned about that 3%er tattoo, which is a hell of a lot different than wearing a T-shirt?
Well, let's also go one step beyond this as well. As much as we may want to frame this in a Kaepernick versus Kaepernick sort of question, in terms of treatment versus treatment of others, let's also look at it from a standpoint even outside of race. And that is where things get to be problematic, because people just stop listening the minute they hear a race. You have a player in the NFL who is affiliated with or who is supporting an organization that essentially supports antagonism, if not overthrow, of the federal government.
Right.
Right. I mean, so you're looking at the Bundys and the Wacos and all of these types of people and all the militia stuff that you've got up there in Idaho and all of this. Is this what you want represented? And can you imagine if you had an African-American player who was even marginally, if somebody walked in on draft day with a T-shirt of the Black Panthers or of Bobby Seale or something? It would be disqualifying for that player. That player would be ostracized and attacked, and it would be a national story. And so even if you take the racial elements away, look at the characteristics, or look at the positions of this organization that he has a tattoo of, and he's affiliated with them. And you can take the black people out of it, and just he needs to answer for that himself.
And it does speak to, again, in terms of how these things are viewed. And the bottom line is this here, whether folks will own it or not, and that is, when you're African-American, there's a much greater scrutiny. You have to explain everything. You have to go through everything, as opposed to how other folks are. And I think that's what we're seeing right here. And let's just be clear. They're sitting here talking about why this kid can't. Oh my God, what he's going through, how he's being treated. How about the kid from the Dallas Cowboys, who was a sure first round draft pick, top 15 draft pick, who the night before, all of a sudden, they said, murder somebody.
Mm-hmm.
And he plummets. And all of a sudden, my bad, he wasn't involved.
Yeah. Well, and that's the other point, because what is taking place here? The framework of all of this is that if you're black in this game, you need to be grateful that we're bringing you into this sport. You are immediately at a disadvantageous position. You're not simply an employee. You're not simply a player. But you're somebody that we're saving. You're somebody that needs to be grateful, because what do they always say about playing in the NFL is a privilege? And those standards don't exist for other players. And that is the pressure. That is that sort of level of anti-blackness that I'm talking about. When you go into the NFL and basketball as well, and baseball to a lesser extent, but especially football, that mindset is, we're doing you a favor for being here, otherwise you can go back to the hood, which is the reason why they feel so, you know, these coaches feel so emboldened to be so brazen in their questioning. And as we saw on draft night as well, you could see the racial components of this dynamic where you look at all of these executives, they're virtually all white. We already know the owners are virtually all white. And this is how they treat the black workforce. And essentially, they gave a pass to a white kicker.
As to talk about that, I want to bring my panel in as well. So let's put Howard in the four box with them. And that is Howard. Speak to this, and then I'm going to go to the panel. There are a lot of black folks, there are a lot of black coaches and others who were pissed off on draft night because you saw the isolation, and what you saw is you saw white after white after white after white after white after white coach or owner or top exec, and they could not add a little color in the back.
Not this time. Not this dynamic. No, and I think this is the thing. After we saw in the Super Bowl, when you saw the Chiefs win the Super Bowl and Eric Bieniemy not get any offers and not get elevated as he would have had he been a white coordinator, is that everybody is starting to see what everybody in the game knows. They're not hiding it. They're letting you know what this dynamic is. And once again, we talk about having power. We talk about players having power or coaches having power, and you realize that they don't really have that much because – you are in this sort of bullseye where they don't have to hire you. And so you can talk about all the Rooney rules as you want. You can talk about diversity and inclusion and all of these different things. But the bottom line is watching that dynamic on draft night, looking at those demographics, they're telling you exactly what this game is. It's white owners, white coaches, black player.
And the bottom line, Greg, I think back as we talk about the tattoo, but also this. Remember when Cam Newton got signed drafted by the Carolina Panthers? Their owner, the first thing you told him, tell me you don't have any tattoos.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of the first things he told him. And when you saw that, I mean, people need to understand, when you see NFL owners who are Trump supporters, who are Republican donors, I was talking to one person who, this person, a very rich African-American, had this Obama shirt. And this person said, they wanted this person to go into the suite of Daniel Snyder. And they said, you're going to wear that because he doesn't like Obama. And this person said, I'm not taking my damn shirt off for him. They said, I can go to another suite. That's what you're dealing with here. And so when you see these white male politics, that's the NFL, Greg. That's real.
Sure it is. And, you know, one of the things I really respect about you, Brother Bryan, is that in the tradition of a Ralph Wiley or my brother Bill Roden or Jemele Hill or Bomani Jones, because you are writing about sports, there are sports writers who will shy away from the political issue. But what you did in this book right here, Full Dissident, that end where you start talking about us being renters in this country,
yeah.
When I look at that boy's arm, I get the white supremacist symbol of the 3%ers, but I also get the white supremacist symbol of the liberty or death and the American flag.
Well, that is
help
funny.
Us,
that's the
help
other
us point. Understand how all of those operate in a field of violence that are signaling this is a white man's country, and all of those symbols mean the same thing in that young man's mind.
Well, that's right, and that was the thing that got me and Bomani and I were talking about this. I said it wasn't just the 3%ers tattoo; it was the other two around it. That we could see also that made it very, very clear what his position is and where he's getting this type of, the types of attitudes. It's not an isolated incident. And I think Bo made a really good point, too, when he and I were on the phone about this, where he had said he was also allowed to have that tattoo. And are you honestly going to tell me that nobody questioned it when they saw it? No one said a word about it? We all know what we're talking about here. And I think that this is this period, Roland, you know, that we're in, right? That we're in, that they are making it very clear who this country belongs to. And they're not hiding it. That's one of the things about Full Dissidents that always, you know, that and the book before that, The Heritage, but especially with Full Dissidents, they tell people all the time that the work that we're doing right now, it's not Watergate. We're not digging up all kinds of sealed documents. It's not the Pentagon Papers. They're not hiding it. They're telling us directly in our faces how they feel about us and who this country belongs to.
Erica, when we start, first of all, Erica, you got a question for Howard.
I do. So having not read your book, but certainly going to be picking that up very soon, but did read William Roden's The $40 Million Slave, and thinking about in that context, what is it, and you mentioned that, you know, really where the power structure does lie. So to a new crop, a new generation, excuse the word crop, but for a new generation of athletes, what do you think should be the permeating message as they consider moving forward and perhaps in their sports career, be it football, baseball, basketball?
Well, it depends. That depends on whose camp you fall in. Do you fall in Carmelo Anthony's camp, or do you fall in my man David Ortiz's camp? And I'll tell you what I mean by that. I remember when David Ortiz was with the Red Sox and he and I were talking, and we were talking about how, you know, from a black standpoint, obviously we know the numbers in baseball are so low. You're down to 7%. There are 68%. There are 68 African Americans in the entire game of Major League Baseball on the field. And the Latinos in the game are looking at 25 to 35%. And so you've got this huge number, but you don't have any Latino managers. You've got a couple. You've got, you've got Davey Martinez, my boy Davey, over at with the Nationals. And you don't have that many against the percentage of the Latino players in the game. And David said to me point blank, that's why I tell all these young guys, get as much money as you can and get your black ass out of the game. That's David's camp. You're not going to get any opportunities. That what's going to happen in this sport, and in some ways, it's the way the Michael Jordan looked at things, which is you're not going to get a real seat at the table. Get as much money as you can. You're going to be compensated. You will get money, but you won't get power. Right. Now, if you go to the Carmelo Anthony camp, when he and I talked about this, his feeling is that you need a new consciousness. You need that these young black athletes need a new consciousness. They need to understand that money can translate into power as long as you don't spend it all on cars. Use what you have and one day create. His feeling is that if the will is there, one day it's possible for these players to begin to make these connections with the really powerful people and to have an owner, a player-based ownership, to have maybe a rival league that's owner and that's player-owned, something like that. Carmelo looks at it very, very differently. So on the one hand, you have some players like David Ortiz, like Poppy and those guys who say, look, we're not going to get anything, but you are going to get money, spend it, save it wisely, and then move on to your second act. On the other hand, you've got Carmelo who says, if you play this properly, there's a role here for you that nobody sees, but you've got to be willing to take the risk to do it.
Reese.
Yeah, my comment was more so about how the NFL bent over backwards to prove to white America that the NFL is patriotic, to try to counter Colin Kaepernick's message of protest, and yet they seem to have no sense of duty or responsibility to prove to black America that they do not agree with white supremacy, that they don't want to take any action to a person they aren't remotely invested in. This person was a draft pick, and it's just simple for them to say, you know what, he has too much baggage, let's move on to somebody else. What do you think that message, what should we do? I know people don't have an appetite for boycott NFL again, or, you know, the NFL might not even have its sports for a while, but as consumers, when are we as black people going to harness our power and say, you need to prove to us that you are not disregarding our consumer power?
Well, I don't think that there's a third way. I think that what people understand is money. I think what owners understand is money. And I think that as long as you look at the black spending power on merchandise, maybe not nearly as much on tickets, but certainly when it comes to merchandise and it comes to the NFL package and it comes to all the different ancillary revenue streams that the NFL gets from the black community, you have to be willing to make a choice to cut that off. I mean, when we talk about boycott, I always go back, you know, you don't want to go back that far into history, obviously, but it is still very instructive that you can't have protests and you can't have boycotts and you can't have a financial stand without taking a risk. That the Montgomery bus boycott lasted a year. They were willing to make that sacrifice through the winter, through the summer. They were willing. What are you willing to risk? Are you ready to say, you know what? The only language you understand is me turning off my TV and me not buying, you know, that Lamar Jackson jersey, and that this is the language that they have to understand, and this is what I'm willing to do. If you're not willing to do that, it's very, very difficult to get anybody to listen because at the end of the day, you gave them your money.
Again, folks, what we're dealing with here is an understanding of sports and power. And so I'm going to have Howard back. Every Thursday we have, of course, our new segment. Well, not new. I talk about it all the time. It'd be Roland's Book Club. We're going to have that every Thursday. And so we're going to have another day. We're going to talk about your book in specifically. And some other stuff I definitely want to cover. But Howard Bryant, I appreciate it, man. Thanks a lot.
Ben.
Okay, so that's the last clip, and I am out of time. So I had a couple more clips left to play, excuse me, so I'm going to save them for next week. I haven't decided on what I'm doing next week, but I will include those clips next week, and it's going to be the clip on the post office and why that's important, so we'll talk about that, and we're going to talk about the sex scandal, which is not a scandal that Joe Biden is in. And the only reason why he's in it because he's running for president. That's all. Every year, you know, some shady shit is always going down, and that's nothing. But that's all that is. So I'll save those clips for next week, and I'll be back here 7:00 p.m. Tuesday with more stuff to talk about. Until then, peace out.